Now to one familiar company that's reinventing itself, Panda Express. You've probably seen it in food courts and airports. Fair or not, it represents what Chinese food has long meant to many Americans, gloppy orange chicken or bland chow mein. Now, as NPR's Netta Ulaby reports, Panda Express is evolving as it tries to keep up with an increasingly sophisticated American palate.
It's crisp and cold outside on this bustling commercial strip in Washington, D.C., but inside Panda Express, it's warm and fragrant. The colors on the wall reflect the heat of the food, citrusy, toasty yellow. 23-year-old Devin Niebrugge has been a Panda Express customer since high school.
It was my entryway into Chinese food. I feel like you start with Panda Express, and when you start to like that, you might start to go to the more local Chinese restaurants and experiment a little more. That's how I learned to eat with chopsticks, actually.
Panda is getting more adventurous along with its customers. For the past 28 years, head chef Andy Cao has worked in the Panda Express test kitchens to stay ahead of food trends.
Before, I just give customer a big chunk of meat, but now I need to make sure nutrition is good.
As it rapidly expands, one of Panda's challenges is countering the perceptions of Chinese food as oily and fried. For the past few years, Panda's made a big point of serving 20 different kinds of vegetables, chopped in-house every day, including broccoli, cabbage, string beans, and mushrooms. Panda Express has emerged from the food court basement into the fastest-growing segment of the restaurant business, called fast casual. Places like Panera Bread and Chipotle have done extremely well during the recession, using fresh ingredients in meals costing less than $10. And to compete in a food-networked world, Chef Andy Cao has had to somehow showcase Panda as being generally appealing yet authentically ethnic.
Yeah, I take responsibility for all the dishes.
Including the orange chicken.
That's Patricia Louie, a Panda Express product manager. She says Panda sells over 60 million pounds of orange chicken every year. Every ounce perfectly calibrated to clobber your pleasure centers.
Sweet and sharp and salty, and you don't want any one flavor to stand out. You want it to be balanced.
To create the next fast food platonic ideal, Louie and Chef Andy Cao have taken over a Panda Express kitchen in suburban Los Angeles. They're testing a brand new recipe for shrimp. Premium ingredients like walnuts and shrimp are part of Panda's plan to go more upscale. But the bottom line is steam table sustainability.
So we'll taste it fresh and then we'll taste it held and we'll see if the flavors and the textures are holding up. If not, then we have to go back and do some more development work.
Right now, Patricia Louie and product development coordinator Adrian Locke are narrowing down sauces from across a range of Asian cuisines.
We had to put out 60, 70 different sauces, taste each one.
And we screened it down to these.
Bringing in tastes from different Asian countries is a great strategy, says Darren Tristano. He's an executive at Technomic, a food consulting company. He says, look at sriracha rooster sauce. Recently, it's everywhere. Americans are craving a flavor profile that Panda's well-positioned to provide.
That spiciness, that teriyaki flavor, the different types of sour and tart and tangy. If you just look at the kids' aisle for candy today, very tart and sour flavors is what kids are looking for.
And older kids, too, like the college students who routinely devour Korean food and Korean frozen yogurt, like Pinkberry. Tristano says there are about 40,000 full-service Asian restaurants in the U.S.
Asian actually represents 13% of all full-service sales, compared to Italian at 11%. Now, Italian used to be larger than Asian, but the two have kind of flipped over the past few years.
Tristano admits that Asian seems like a ridiculously broad category compared to Italian, but Panda is playing up being Pan-Asian. One stop for your Chinese, your Korean, your Thai.
What do you have that's spicy?
The spicy one?
What do you have spicy?
The final version of that shrimp in the test kitchen landed on Panda's steam tables last week. It uses spicy Thai green peppercorns. Sales are up 5%. But customer Devin Niebrugge says Panda can innovate all at once. Nothing could persuade her to order anything but her beloved orange chicken.
And you know it's always like the biggest tray on their little buffet line. Like everyone eats it.
A few new pandas open every month, most recently in Mexico City. There's about 1,500 of them total. Over the long term, Panda plans to express itself to the tune of 10,000 restaurants all over the world. Netta Ulaby, NPR News.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Good morning. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Renee Montaigne. Let's look more closely now at President Obama's proposal to overhaul the corporate tax system. His plan would sharply cut the taxes that U.S. companies pay and also eliminate many loopholes. White House spokesman Jay Carney says the proposal should have broad appeal.
We believe that the reception so far has been positive and will be positive because it does what so many people say is important to do, which is, and this is Democrats and Republicans, which is lower the rate, broaden the base, eliminate the underbrush of unnecessary subsidies and loopholes and special provisions that complicate the tax code.
But listen carefully to a few of those words Carney just spoke. You'll hear why the plan faces an uphill battle in Congress. He said, broaden the base. That phrase means making more income from more people subject to taxation. Business lobbyists know that means eliminating popular tax breaks. NPR's Jim Zaroli reports.
At least on paper, U.S. companies pay a tax rate of 35%, higher than just about any other advanced country. And Scott Hodge, president of the Tax Foundation, says that leaves U.S. corporations at a big disadvantage.
75 countries have cut their corporate tax rates. And if we look at the rest of the world, it's a very competitive place compared to the United States.
But at the same time, the U.S. tax code is larded with exemptions, deductions, and credits of all kinds. And Bob McIntyre of Citizens for Tax Justice says most big companies know how to take advantage of them.
Right now, we have a 35% nominal corporate tax rate, but our big corporations, on average, pay about half that, about 18%.
The plan unveiled by the Obama administration would cut the corporate tax rate to 28%, but it would also get rid of a lot of those loopholes. The plan would impose a minimum tax on the money that companies make overseas, something proponents say would cut down on the use of offshore tax havens. Administration officials say a simpler tax code would save a lot of companies money. Joel Slemrod is a professor of economics at the University of Michigan.
Companies spend an enormous amount of money, not just complying with the tax system, but planning about how to make use of these complexities and the differences in tax systems across countries to their best advantage.
To Scott Hodge of the Tax Foundation, which lobbies for lower taxes, the effort to reform the system has come none too soon.
Well, I think at least the administration should be given some credit for recognizing the U.S. corporate tax rate is well out of step with the rest of the world and needs reform.
But Hodge said the tax cut didn't go far enough. He also took issue with one part of the proposal that would cut the tax rate even further for manufacturers. Administration officials said they want to promote the creation of manufacturing jobs because they pay better and because they tend to lead to other kinds of job creation. Conservatives say that amounts to the government picking winners and losers instead of letting the market do it. The U.S. Chamber of Commerce warned yesterday that it would vigorously oppose efforts to pit one industry against another. The idea is opposed by some liberal groups, too. Bob McIntyre of Citizens for Tax Justice notes that manufacturers already get big tax breaks.
You take a company like Boeing, for example. The president was just out to visit them last week. Boeing hasn't paid a nickel in federal income taxes over the last 10 years. I don't know how you can cut their taxes any further. You really ought to be raising them.
But such a move is unlikely to get through Congress, especially in an election year. Joel Slemrod says hacking away at the thicket of tax credits and exemptions tends to be a tough sell in Washington, and lawmakers who try to do it quickly back down.
In the past, anyway, the companies that pay more scream louder than the companies that pay less applaud.
Still, there is widespread agreement that the tax code, with its many complexities and inequities, needs to be overhauled and that it would benefit the economy in the long run. The administration's proposal could set the stage for just such a reform later on. Jim Zaroli, NPR News.
Now that banks and large investors have taken possession of thousands of foreclosed rental properties, turns out the new owners are not always model landlords. From construction to upkeep, some banks are leaving tenants to live in squalor. NPR's Arthi Shahani reports.
Pedro Jimenez signed the lease for his second floor apartment in 2006. Since then,
he was leaking water, part of the ceiling fall. You can see the windows crack.
Cracked? Try shattered. Vandals broke them, he says. East Oakland, California is rough. Abandoned buildings, crime. Still, it's home to the single dad with four kids. 7-year-old David plays handyman. While his dad patches walls with plywood, David covers holes with sticky notes. There are yellow squares in every room but one.
That bathroom's nasty.
Do you ever go in here?
No, only my dad. Because it's dirty and it's nasty.
That's kid speak for dangerous. Broken plumbing, splintered wood, exposed electrical wires. The original landlord was renovating when he lost the place in foreclosure. That was in 2007. Jimenez recalls some realtor coming by to collect rent for the new owner, Deutsche Bank. Soon the water stopped running altogether because no one paid the bill. The utility company wouldn't let Jimenez pay just his part. They take only full payment for all units in a building. So, he recalls, he lifted a meter from a vacant home and reinstalled it in his. It was
the illegal way, you know. I was doing legally.
Jimenez doesn't know that Deutsche Bank actually isn't his landlord. It's the trustee representing a pool of investor owners. J.P. Morgan Chase, the loan servicer, handles maintenance and tenants. They've never spoken. And bank employees and Jimenez disagree about why repairs haven't happened and why rent payments stopped last year. According to Paul Leonard, banks are taking back homes that no one else can afford to buy. He's senior vice president of the Housing Policy Council, a trade group for the biggest housing market investors.
Banks don't want to take your home and own it.
They're stuck, he says. Plumbing and light fixtures, that's well beyond their mission.
You know, a bank is not in the business of being a property manager. They have to hire a property manager to take care of the property.
And are banks doing that?
Well, I think it varies. I think some are better than others. I think that what banks would like to do is they would prefer a clean sale to someone that can handle it.
The sheer volume is overwhelming, says Leonard. The Oakland City attorney says foreclosed properties are being bought and sold so quickly, it's hard to know whom to hold responsible for what. And banks, they don't return city calls. Overwhelmed or not, the U.S. Treasury recently wrote banks, warning them that they must fulfill their duties as landlords. It's a nationwide concern. In Maryland, bank regulator Ann Norton says that for tenants and local authorities,
the challenge is just finding the new landlord, because in many cases it's difficult to find a real live human being that is going to take responsibility for that property.
That's difficult even when there is a property manager. Take Luz Escamilla in Hyattsville, Maryland.
At night, what we do is keep the light on and don't sleep, waiting for the bugs to come up.
She means bed bugs. There are chocolate-colored blotches all over her walls. It's blood. Not hers, the bed bugs. Escamilla pays $1,200 a month in rent. When the management company wouldn't fumigate for bugs or fix broken stoves, she and other tenants set out to find the landlord. Casa de Maryland, a local nonprofit, helped track down CW Capital, the servicer. CW Capital granted a meeting in their high-rise office building in Washington, D.C. Sitting across a conference table, tenants faced men in suits. When one started talking finance, organizer Lindolfo Carballo recalls,
one of the tenants stood up and said, you know what, I don't want to hear that. I want to hear, when are you going to put my cabinets back in my kitchen?
CW Capital declined NPR's request for an interview. But tenants say a company rep did end up visiting them and even repaired those cabinets. Bed bugs and other problems, though, remain untreated. So tenants sued in housing court. Ann Norton, the Maryland bank regulator, says it's often more challenging to take a bank to court than a mom-and-pop landlord.
Due to disproportional bargaining rights between tenants and the parties that are the investors, tenants feel that they don't have a voice and also don't have rights.
States are at a loss, too. Norton says they aren't sure how to make banks comply with their housing codes. She and 9 other regulators are now drafting guidelines. Aarti Shahani, NPR News.
While most of the sports world has an eye on basketball and hockey, did you know it's also monster truck season?
The Advance Auto Parts Monster Jam. Monster Jam. Back for its 30th anniversary celebration. Four-time world champion, Gravedigger.
I know, too loud. But a funny thing happens on the way to a Monster Jam show. A contagious level of giddiness from the fans, most of them kids, over the awesome destruction on the way.
A flip
crash the cars!
Monster Jam events draw more than 4 million people a year to arenas like the Verizon Center here in downtown Washington, D.C. What started in the late 70s as intermission entertainment for tractor pull competitions is now a multi-million dollar industry that tours the world.
Are you guys ready to see the Advanced Auto Parts Monster Jam Wheelie Competition?
This year, the marquee star of the Monster Jam Tour, Gravedigger. It's celebrating its 30th anniversary.
On the course right now, Rod Smith and the black and green wrecking machine, Gravedigger.
To find out what it's like behind the wheel of the black and green wrecking machine, we snuck into the arena before the show. Gone was the basketball court, tractors were still spreading red dirt around the floor, and the junkyard cars in the middle of the pit were getting a coat of yellow paint. Rod Schmidt, one of Gravedigger's drivers, gave us the tour.
Are you ready to get in? I can tell your eyes are getting bigger. You're like a crazy fan right now. I love it.
Obviously, Gravedigger is big. Like elephant big. Twice the height of the average basketball player.
Left foot.
Yeah. Right foot.
Oh.
Big step. There you go.
Okay.
Now left foot again.
On the outside, there's a ghoulish skeleton head painted on the black cab and bright green flames painted on the hood. It sits on a neon green frame and shock absorbers the length of hockey sticks. At 5'4", I'm not quite as tall as the hand-carved tires.
It's really high.
Inside, it's stripped bare, except for a single driver's seat and some ominous-looking buttons.
The little switch, the hand switch over there on your right, that looks like a little bar.
Yeah.
That's for the rear steer. So you put your hand on there and you can steer.
The original Gravedigger was built back in 1981 by a mud bog hobbyist named Dennis Anderson out of a 1950s-era Chevy and the wheels of a tractor. The truck became a huge hit because of its horsepower and ability for maximum destruction. The machine Schmidt is standing in front of today is far more complex.
Each tire weighs about 600 pounds.
Approximately 11 and a half feet tall.
Weighs about 10,000 pounds.
Motors 1,500 horse.
Custom built tube chassis.
This will run you up to $200,000. And that's before you buy the semi to take it on tour.
For me. Our mileage is probably 10 gallons to a mile.
No hybrids here. And the sport, yes, the sport, has come a long way. It's not just about crushing cars anymore.
We crush the cars, yes, but do we crush them like we used to in the old day? No. You know, we bang them up a little bit. We smash in the roof, smash in the sides, but not nearly as bad as we used to.
And the shocks seem so good. I can't imagine you actually feel them under the tires.
Yeah, you feel them, but not to the extent where you think you would. You know, like a pothole in the city, that's what they feel like. It's a bump in the road, so to speak.
Only it's a full-size sedan.
Yeah, it's a full-size bump. Yeah.
So instead of maybe running over a sedan and calling it a day, monster truck drivers compete for trophies and sponsorships. They go head-to-head in racing competitions, leaping over massive dirt ramps. In the freestyle segment, they earn points for tricks. They stand the trucks up on their back wheels. They travel 100 feet in the air over stacks of cars and rows of school buses. It's kind of like a figure skating routine, but much, much louder. So Monster Jam is a competition. You guys are ranked.
Absolutely.
The rule book's pretty thick. Talk a little bit about...
Yes.
The sport.
We go by a rule book just like every other race association. You know, people think it's a show, and it is show, it's entertainment, but we also race. We race for real and we freestyle for real. We race for points, we freestyle for points, you know, so, and that score gets calculated throughout the year, you know, so you get power ranked. So we are a show, but yet we're racers.
What do you do when you have to go back to your regular car? Like, do you have a regular car?
I got a regular car. I drive a Yukon, so this is kind of a release for me. You know, so my driving style on the highways are a lot different than they are in the arena, you know. I'm a pretty good driver. I'm pretty calm. No speeding tickets, believe it or not. I drive a little faster than I probably should. But I take all my frustrations out here. You know, it's like an altered ego. I get to come out here and just absolutely have fun with this thing, and I go back to my regular car, and it's la-di-da.
Rod Schmidt has driven Gravedigger for more than a decade now, but he says before each show, he still gets just as excited as the first day he got behind the wheel.
Sitting back there, listening to the national anthem and stuff, your heart starts beating a little faster. You can kind of hear the fans. Your blood starts pumping. And as soon as they give you the green light to hit the floor, you're on the gas. You know, you hit the floor, and all of a sudden the crowd just goes crazy.
That's Rod Schmidt, pilot of the Gravedigger Monster Truck, which is on tour now with the Advanced Auto Parts Monster Jam series. To see photos of Rod Schmidt and Gravedigger up close, go to NPR.org.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.